It's not possible for me to talk about ILIAC alone because there were two computers built at the University of Illinois as a result of a decision to share costs of development with Aberdeen Proving Grounds. So the ORDVAC was built first, was completed late in 1951, and the ILIAC was completed in September of 1952. The two computers were not program compatible for reasons which I will get into later. Now, I don't feel it's proper for me to serve as a representative of the team that built these computers without at least giving credit to some of the people. And if I may have the first overhead projection. The permanent faculty involved were Ralph Meager, who was chief engineer. Ralph has a very strong sense of both personal and professional integrity, and credit for the success of these computers should go to him. Jack Nash was the diplomat of the group. He later became vice president in charge of research at Lockheed, and died as a result of a piece of steak in his windpipe during a visit to Cape Canaveral for one of the Apollo shots. Abe Taub is a mathematician. He insisted, and I will always be grateful to him for it, that whenever we proposed a scheme for arithmetic, multiplication, or division, that it be formulated precisely mathematically. And I think it was this insistence that led to the changes that we made in some of the procedures for multiplication and division. In particular, the multiplication as proposed at the Institute essentially involved the product of the digits other than the signs of the multiplier and multiplicand. And this meant that when the multiplicand was negative, there had to be a certain set of corrections. When the multiplier was negative, there was another complicated set of corrections. And it was the insistence on formulation, that mathematical formulation, that led us to realize that one could avoid one set of corrections if one treated the multiplicand as a number which could be either positive or negative, and one could perform essentially the sum of two numbers followed by a shift in an arithmetically correct fashion. This is a trivial matter now, but in those days it appeared to be a significant achievement. If I may have the next overhead projection. I have, in the interest of brevity, listed a few, the names of a few of the graduate students, visitors, etc., who were associated with the later stages of the development. And I must apologize, of course, to those people whose names are not included here. Don Gillies was associated with the programming. Ed Hughes is primarily in the circuits area. My own activities were concerned with the design of the control and logical design insofar as some of the arithmetic was concerned. Dave Wheeler, who I'm very happy to see here, was unique in that he was the only one of the group who had had any experience. The rest of us were involved in on-the-job training, as it were. And he was a visitor from Cambridge, the University of Cambridge, that's in England. Is due to him that the Ordvak and the Iliac were not program compatible, or in part. And this indeed was a contribution because the instruction format for the Ordvak was quite awkward in that Radix 16 format was used and the 10 bits were used for the instruction and 10 bits for the address, and this meant that the there was an overlap in the third character between part of the instruction and part of the address, and this was very awkward, and it was due to Wheeler's suggestion that the instruction format was reduced to 8 bits, making it compatible with a Radix 16 format. The other contribution among many that David made was the incorporation of alphanumeric facilities for alphanumeric input and output. The Ordvak and the original plans for Iliac provided only for numbers in the sexadecimal range from 0 through 15. Joe Weir was concerned with the Williams memory. And I would like to turn now to some slides which were taken by Sandy Douglas, if I am correct, about 20 years ago. And I'll discuss some of the properties of the machine in that connection. I don't know whether we can see that very well, but it indicates the register arrangement. Yes, if we could turn off this light here. But like all members of the family, the shifting registers were double rank registers. So the two upper rows are the accumulator and its secondary rank. There is another shifting register for which there are no lights in this region, and that is the multiplier quotient register. You can see that the word length is 40 bits. There are 10 lights in each of these four bays. The next row here is the operand register. It's a single rank register to which numbers are brought from memory. And the bottom row contains a pair of instructions, 8 bits for the instruction and 10 bits for the address. The green area here is a view of one of the 40 digital positions of the memory. It was possible to get a global picture, as it were, of the program. And the areas of program activity, of course, were brighter than the others. Now, if I may have the next slide. This, of course, is very similar to all members of the Institute family and was a direct copy of the Institute computer. Well, this is just a view of part of the control area. Let's move on to the next. Input and output were by punched paper tape, and modified teletype machines were used. Next. In the preparation of programs, if mistakes occurred, which they quite often did, it was necessary to prepare another tape, in which the offending word had been corrected. And of course, it was necessary to compare tapes, and this is a tape comparing device, so that one could be sure that what one copied remained unchanged, except where one wanted it changed. Next. That's Sandy Douglas at the tape reader. This is the control console. It consists of three switches which I liberated from war surplus and donated for this purpose. The leftmost switch, the white one there, has three positions. In the topmost position, it results in a single instruction being brought from storage. In the center position, that instruction is then executed and was therefore possible by manipulating that switch from in the two upper positions to execute instructions one at a time. In the lower position, is called the run position, and programs then run continuously. The center switch, the black one, has three positions. There was an instruction which, again for program debugging, which was a stop instruction conditional on the position of that switch, so that the user of the machine could strategically place such instructions in his program, and during the debugging phase, look at the registers and see how the data was changing, and then after the program was debugged, put the switch in the lowermost position. There was also a permanent stop instruction, which consisted of all zeros. That happened to correspond to a shift instruction of no places. The address of the shift instruction indicated how many shifts were to be performed. Now, this being an asynchronous machine, if you instructed it to do nothing, it had no way of knowing that nothing had been done, and so it stopped. And the purpose of the third position of the black switch was to enable one to bypass such a stop as a result of the machine not having received instructions to do anything. The third switch, the orange one, was for test purposes primarily, and enabled the engineers to obey a pair of instructions over and over again with the addresses taken from a counter. An example of this was a simple memory test, which consisted of the pair of instructions complement the number from storage. The second instruction was store it back, and it would be stored back in the same location. And then as the counter increased, one would move to the next storage location and complement it, and so one would get it. If one started with a pattern of all zeros, it would change to a pattern of all ones and then back to all zeros, and thereby gave us a quick and dirty test of the storage unit of the memory. I believe there's another slide or two. May I have the next slide, please? Oh, that's just a general view. Again, the cathode ray tube that allowed us to look at any one of the 40 memory positions, one digit at a time. This is a 40 position switch, allowing us to select which one we wanted. The control panel and the registers, which I've described before. The input devices there for paper tape. Next. And Sandy Douglas is training his daughter to be an operator at the computer. Now, how much time do I have, John? Well, I wanted to say just spend a little time on an anecdote. Fine. There is time for an anecdote involving Don Gillies, and I would like in some sense or other to dedicate this to Don, who died rather suddenly 11 months ago. And this concerns the checkout of the Iliac, which occurred over Labor Day weekend of 1952. The technicians completed the wiring of the iliac on Friday before Labor Day. It happened to be one of Meagher's very rare holidays. He left for the weekend. And so Joe Weir and Don Gillies and I decided we might as well get the machine running over the weekend. Well, Weir, as I've mentioned, was the person concerned with the memory, and this was attacked first. And the memory was of the Williams type, as I've said. And there were a number of problems with Williams memories. I like to use the mud puddle analogy in describing how such a memory works. If you have a smooth layer of mud and a source of water, imagine the following pair of experiments. This is the analogy to storing one bit. If you drop water in one spot, the mud, you'll create a little hole in the surface of the mud. That's experiment number one. Experiment number two is you drop the water in that hole and then you move it a little bit. This is technically called a twitch. Now, if you then go back later in order to read, then you will get one sort of response in the form of mud being spattered out. If you have not, if the spot has not been moved, and you will get a different response from the original position if the spot has been moved, because the mud will have been redistributed. And this difference is, of course, sensed as a voltage from the surface of a cathode ray tube, and results in there being a one or a zero. Now, the problems with this sort of memory, of course, were first read around, which means that if you have another bit stored in the neighborhood, the mud spattered from that can go into the hole of your, and eventually fill the hole and cause an error. The other sort of problem was that we were using commercial cathode ray tubes. We were using 3-inch tubes, by the way. These had flaws on the surface. And even though we went through a good bit of selection to eliminate these, they were not entirely gone during this weekend. And so we went to a local drugstore and bought what were some toys called tricky dogs. These are little plastic dogs, perhaps 5/8 of an inch long, mounted on magnets, so arranged that, so polarized, that the dogs were uncomfortable when they were head to head. At any rate, we took we took these little magnets and put them near the surface of the offending cathode ray tubes, the ones with flaws, and the magnetic field was sufficient to move the raster sufficiently to get them away from flaws. And so, after treating the memory in this fashion, in a sufficient number of positions, it was sufficiently reliable so that we could continue. Well, now ultimately we persuaded cathode ray tube manufacturers to generate cathode ray tubes for us, especially prepared and with the much tighter quality control on the phosphor. And this problem became was overcome. Well, Gillies and I proceeded to check out the diagnostic routine, which was the Leapfrog written by David Wheeler. And this was called the Leapfrog, of course, because it there were five copies maintained. In the process of execution, a new copy was generated and compared with one of the older copies, and a number of comparisons were made to make sure that, the program then moved at the completion of the generation of a new copy to a different copy. In other words, the location of the program changed after I believe 128 words were copied. And hence it was called the leapfrog. It also included a number of basic tests of multiplication, division, and it included all the it used all the instructions and tested them in various forms. I'm not doing justice to this, and I hope David will feel free to comment. Now, Gillies and I then proceeded to work 16-hour days, starting about 10 in the morning and winding up about, 3 or 4 in the morning. And he would debug a portion of the leapfrog and on that basis find things wrong with the computer, and I would then go around with a soldering iron and correct the offending portions, and that would enable us to use the leapfrog a bit more and find more errors in that, and so we would jump back and forth between debugging the program and debugging the machine until finally we accomplished both. And by Labor Day, it was possible for, I think it was Dave Clutterham and Bob Gregory to debug some of their programs. The final blow, of course, as far as the leapfrog was concerned, was involved the sum check, which was incorporated on the tape as a test of the reading mechanism and to guarantee that the program was correctly in storage. A sum of associated with the words that had been read in was maintained. To this sum, a new word, the digits of a new word were added, and then some strange sort of shift occurred in order that no particular bias for digital position bias would exist. Unfortunately, there was no way of guaranteeing from looking at the sum what should be punched on the tape to make the sum come out zero. And it became necessary to try to devise a scheme of trying to guess what that number ought to be and trying to find a process that would ultimately converge so that the sum would be zero. And I don't think Don and I ever forgave Dave Wheeler for that particular facet of the sum check. Okay. Well, why don't I simply ask for questions now, if there are any.
Jack Howlett. One very simple question. I think it's right that Iliac 1 ran for a remarkably long time, Could you give us, in fact,
yes,
a closing
it, it
down,
was,
date?
It was the primary computing facility of the university for some 6 or 8 years, I believe.
Sure, I think it was more than that. I went to it really nice several times.
Well, no, it continued in operation until 1962 or 3. It's not true, John, that I was responsible for its death.
No.
You waited until I went on sabbatical leave in Australia before you dared tear it apart.
Could I go on with another quote? I think, you see, one talks a lot about machines that were made and worked and so on, but one might learn at some point, you know, quite a lot of things that perhaps weren't so successful. And I hope this isn't too painful, but I do remember hearing quite a lot, both visiting Urbana and from the people coming to England, about ELIAC 3, which was a sort of pattern recognition machine, which I think, to be fair, it never got finished, did it? And, you know, is there something one can learn from that?
I'd prefer to pass the buck to you, John, on that one.
Well, the problem was that there was a catastrophic fire during the construction of the machine, and then the builder of the machine left the university. So I guess the motto of the thing is you shouldn't depend on one person or something. I don't know.
It had some very ingenious features, hadn't it? I think it was sort of 1024-bit word and a lot of curious things. It'd be a great pity, I think, at a conference if the history of that got lost.
History is not lost. The National Science Foundation, in fact, has a grant to have that history developed. There is a grant to write up the report on the ELIAC 3.